Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the December 1st, 2023 issue of the Week. The cover drawing this week is a wrestling rink. It looks like it's actually in the U.S. House of Representatives on the floor there. Mike Johnson, the recently elected Speaker of the House, is the referee, although he's not doing much. Kevin McCarthy has just jumped off the ropes, and he's about to elbow. I think his name is Tim Burchett. And then in the foreground, screaming and making a strong pose with his fist clenched, is Oklahoma Senator Mark Wayne Mullen. The headline is "Ready to Rumble: Why Republican Lawmakers Are Trading Jabs and Making Threats." We get that story of the controversy of the week. We'll start with the first main story and how it was covered. Israel-Hamas near hostage and ceasefire deal. What happened? Israel and Hamas appeared this week to be on the verge of a deal that would see the terrorist group free some of its 240 Israeli hostages in exchange for the release of Palestinian prisoners and a temporary ceasefire, which would be the first significant pause in fighting since the war began on October 7th. Under the proposed deal brokered by Qatar with the involvement of U.S. officials, Hamas would release 50 women and children captured during its deadly attack on Israel last month, officials told the Wall Street Journal. Israel would release 150 Palestinians, pause fighting for 4 or 5 days, and allow 300 truckloads of humanitarian aid to enter Gaza. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said the possible deal is the right decision, but he added that the war would go on until Israel met its objectives, including eradicating Hamas and bringing all hostages back. Health officials in Hamas-run Gaza said more than 13,000 Palestinians have been killed in the war so far, including some 5,000 children. International anger over Israel's offensive has swelled as the Israeli military has targeted hospitals, where it says Hamas is hiding command centers. Gaza's largest hospital, Al-Shifa, is no longer functioning after an Israeli raid last week. Israel released footage from the interior of what it says is a Hamas-built tunnel below the medical facility. It also released hospital security camera footage from October 7th that shows two hostages being taken inside the building by armed fighters. Israel said the bodies of two other hostages, both women, were found near the complex. The World Health Organization said most of Gaza's hospitals have either shut down or are providing only basic services, while a UN aid group said Gazan civilians face the immediate possibility of starvation amid a massive food shortage. What the columnist said, "To enter Gaza now is to arrive in hell," said Steve Hendricks in the Washington Post. "On a recent pass through northern Gaza with the Israeli military, I was stunned by the destruction. Entire neighborhoods have been reduced to a shattered warscape, pungent with the sour stench of decaying bodies. A vital center of Palestinian culture and identity, where children played, donkey carts navigated chaotic intersections, and fishermen sold their catches on the sidewalks, is now a smoking, reeking ruin. The human toll is even worse," said Raja Abdul Rahim in the New York Times. "Gaza has become a graveyard for children, engulfed by trauma and pain. Parents have taken to writing their children's names on their skin in case they are killed or orphaned and need to be identified. At Al-Aqsa Hospital, So many children have arrived at the morgue that director Yasser Abu Ammar has cut his burial shrouds into child-sized fragments to handle the influx of corpses. The bodies are broken and in pieces, Ammar said. We cry every day. Those children's deaths are an atrocity, but it is Hamas' atrocity, not Israel, said Kevin D. Williamson in the Dispatch. It is Hamas that chose this war with its massacre of 1,200 Israelis on October 7th, giving Israel the moral imperative to annihilate a remorseless enemy bent on its destruction. It's Hamas that chose to put Palestinian children between themselves and Israeli forces and turned hospitals into legitimate targets by using them as hidey holes to cower in. Evidence of such tactics can't be denied, said the New York Post in an editorial. There's video showing a 55-meter section of tunnel beneath Al-Shifa, fitted with a blast-proof door and a firing hole next to a shed filled with deadly weaponry. But Western reporters too often shut out facts that counter their narrative of Israel being the aggressor and Hamas the victim, a precise inversion of reality. A hostage deal may bring a short ceasefire, but anything longer is a complete non-starter for the Israelis, said Max Boot in the Washington Post. Still reeling from October 7th, they are totally committed to dismantling Hamas. And Israel is winning that war, steadily expanding its hold on northern Gaza in the face of relatively limited resistance. But with much of the world horrified by the brutality of Israel's campaign, the country is losing the battle for public opinion, and the political clock is ticking. As Israel shifts its focus to southern Gaza, the humanitarian situation may worsen, said David S. Cloud and Jared Malson in the Wall Street Journal. Hamas fighters who've fled south will prove a more determined adversary, having nowhere else to go. Meanwhile, civilians who've escaped the north are now packed into the area, and U.S. officials are urging Israel to formulate plans to protect them. The hardest stage of the war may well lie ahead. Controversy of the week. Congress. Why are GOP lawmakers threatening violence? Congress has spent much of the year wallowing in its own dysfunction, said Robert Jemison in the New York Times. But the infighting is no longer figurative. Representative Kevin McCarthy last week allegedly elbowed Representative Tim Burchett, a Republican from Tennessee, who in October voted to remove McCarthy as House Speaker, in the kidneys while passing him in a corridor. McCarthy denied the assault but bragged, "If I kidney punched someone, they would be on the ground." Elsewhere in the House, Representative James Comer, Republican from Kentucky, sneered at Representative Jared Moskowitz, the Democrat from Florida, who happened to be wearing a blue suit, declaring, "You look like a Smurf." At a Senate hearing on corporate profits, Senator Mark Wayne Mullen ordered Teamsters President Sean O'Brien, with whom he'd been feuding on social media, to, quote, "stand your butt up." The Oklahoma Republican, a former MMA fighter, was taking off his wedding ring to throw a punch at O'Brien when Senator Bernie Sanders gaveled him to order. Mullen later refused to apologize and even suggested that a return to the days of fistfights and canings in Congress might help restore respect for the institution, said Daniel Schumann in The Hill. What Mullen left unsaid was that the bulk of those confrontations, including the 1856 near-fatal caning of Senator Charles Sumner, occurred in the mid-1800s as a polarized nation descended in a violent downward spiral to civil war. The catalyst then was slavery, said Dennis Aftergut in The Bulwark. This time, it's Donald Trump. Mullen, McCarthy, and their fellow Republicans are taking cues from their party's most powerful figure, a thuggish ex-president whose love of childish insults is exceeded only by his fascination with the use of force to win political disputes. After 8 years of Trump's dominance, is it really surprising that GOP leaders feel it's okay to cold cock someone you don't like in a Capitol hallway? Many Republican voters, too, have come to relish and emulate Trump's smash-mouth style, said Hannah Knowles in the Washington Post. They wear F. Biden T-shirts, refer to Vice President Kamala Harris as the hoe, and elect politicians who mirror Trump's coarseness and cruelty. Trump may be the master of ceremonies, said Jessica Gross in the New York Times, but we're living through a larger crisis of juvenile masculinity. At a time when actual violence is declining, violent crime and high school fights are trending down, American men are performing their maleness with a theatrical swagger we usually associate with adolescence. Look at this summer's on-off cage match between billionaires Mark Zuckerberg and Elon Musk. I just don't think we can be a functional society if this desire to settle differences with violence becomes the new norm. We should be careful about diagnosing national ills from the GOP's very specific state of dysfunction, said historian Joanne B. Freeman in Politico. We're seeing these outbursts in Congress primarily from and between Republicans because the party is absolutely fractured. On the one side are traditional conservatives who want to legislate, and on the other an angry MAGA faction inspired by Trump but not controlled by him, that wants to fight and knows the old rules of decorum no longer apply. The schoolyard taunts and skirmishes of recent weeks are simply what Republican governance looks like in 2023, said Dana Milbank in the Washington Post. A daily soap opera of rage, nihilism, and backstabbing that delivers one kidney punch after another to competent leadership. Here's our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It was a good week for corrections after the New York Times informed readers that the geographic region in which black vultures snip and consume the umbilical cords of sea lions is in fact South America, not Northern California, as stated in a recent Science article. It was a good week for hazards after Rory McIlroy's tee shot on the 13th hole of the World Tour Championship in Dubai, landed in the lap of a female spectator lying down near the green. Once the referee arrived, he allowed the woman to stand up and gave McIlroy a free drop. It was a good week for diplomacy after President Biden, during his recent summit with Chinese President Xi Jinping, asked Xi to wish his wife, Ping Luan, a happy birthday. Xi said he was embarrassed by Biden's kind words, having forgotten that Ping's birthday was coming up. But it was a bad week for privacy after an unidentified Torontonian posted a listing seeking an easygoing female to rent one half of a queen-size bed in a single room. One local realtor noted a queen-size mattress is barely wide enough for a pillow barrier to be erected down its midline. It was a bad week for cartography after TikTok user Sabrienne Abre went viral with a video in which she declared her shock at learning that Alaska, often depicted on U.S. maps in a separate box, is not an island. I have so many questions for the U.S. education system, she said. Finally, it was a bad week for austerity after the Canadian government revealed it had spent nearly $500,000 hiring KPMG consultants to advise on how to cut costs. Officials said the high-priced consultants were needed to ensure that Canadians' tax dollars are being used efficiently. And a short and other news piece, a wave of House exits. Representative Tony Cardenas, Democrat from California, announced this week that he won't seek re-election in 2024, bringing the number of House members who are retiring or running for another position to 20 Democrats and 10 Republicans. That exceptional rate of departures reflects mounting frustration in the House with relentless spending battles and recent marathon votes to oust and then replace Speaker Kevin McCarthy. It's not the quantity of retirements, former Representative Steve Israel, Democrat from New York, said. It's the quality. The brain drain is especially stark for the 52-member delegation from California, which is losing Cardenas and Grace Napolitano to retirement, while Katie Porter, Barbara Lee, and Adam Schiff leave to compete for an open Senate seat, a collective loss of nearly 90 years of legislative experience. The title of this week's briefing is A Nation Moving Apart. Americans are increasingly sorting themselves into communities with shared politics. Is this bad for democracy? How politically segregated is the U.S.? Democratic and Republican voters are now more geographically clustered within states than at any point since the Civil War, according to a recent study by economists at the University of Maryland and Northwestern University. Nearly 80% of Americans today live in a state where a single party controls both the governorship and the legislature. And there are also sharp partisan divides within states. The Cook Political Report rates about 81% of the country's 435 congressional districts as non-competitive for 2024, up from 58% in 1999. That's in part because of gerrymandering, explains analyst Dave Wasserman, but mostly because the electorate has simply become much more homogenous in many districts. A 2021 Harvard study found at least 98% of Americans live in census tracts with some level of partisan segregation. For about 25 million voters, segregation is so extreme that only 1 in 10 neighborhood encounters is likely to be with a supporter of the opposite party. Even within a neighborhood, Democrats and Republicans are separating from each other a little bit, said study co-author Ryan D. Enos. There's something pretty fundamental going on here. What's driving geographic polarization? Some Americans deliberately moved for political reasons, such as objections to new state laws on abortion, firearms, or LGBTQ rights, and in recent years, COVID restrictions. Lynn Seeden, a 59-year-old portrait photographer from Orange County, California, relocated to the Dallas-Fort Worth area in 2021. At her first stop for gas in Texas, people weren't wearing masks. Nobody cared, she told NPR. It's kind of like heaven on earth. In one March poll, 40% of Americans said they were somewhat or very likely to relocate to a state that better fit their political beliefs. But research suggests few move solely for political reasons. A census survey found 84% of Americans who moved in 2022 did so for jobs, housing, or family. Still, partisan sorting happens anyway because many pocketbook concerns overlap with political ones. In 2022, 817,669 people left California. 545,598 left New York, and 344,027 left Illinois, mostly to low-tax, lower-cost red states such as Florida and Texas, which gained 738,969 and 668,338 new residents, respectively. And geographical polarization is not simply a result of people moving, but also of long-term changes within the two parties and their constituencies. What kind of changes? Before the 1970s, the major parties were far less ideologically uniform. The Northeast had plenty of socially liberal Rockefeller Republicans, while the South had many socially conservative Democrats. But Democratic involvement in civil rights legislation led some white Southerners to switch parties. And the culture wars of the 1970s and 80s sorted liberals into the Democratic Party and conservatives into the GOP. Over recent decades, the urban-rural divide between the parties has also expanded into a chasm. In the 2020 presidential election, Joe Biden won 91% of the country's most populous counties, while Donald Trump took more than 2,500 of the remaining 3,000 counties. Increasingly, Democrats are higher-educated city dwellers who work in white-collar jobs, while more of the rural white working class has trended Republican. Is partisan sorting a problem? For individuals, it can feel comforting to live among people with similar beliefs and backgrounds, and under a state government that enacts policies they support. But such segregation could be bad for the nation's political health. Groups of like-minded people tend to become more extreme over time in the way that they're like-minded, said Bill Bishop, author of The Big Sort. Such clustering can reinforce the sense that people outside the bubble are the enemy. In a 2022 Pew survey, majorities of Democrats and Republicans said they viewed members of the other party as more immoral and dishonest. Under half of each party said the same in 2016. With fewer voters in the middle, lawmakers have less incentive to reach across the aisle and compromise. And with less compromise and experimentation needed, states increasingly emulate policies enacted by other states controlled by the same party, or follow the agenda of partisan interest groups such as the National Rifle Association. The old phrase, all politics is local, no longer applies to the political parties, said political scientist Jacob Grumbach, but it does apply to American political institutions. Can this polarization be reduced? Not easily. Party affiliation has become as much a cultural identity with its own set of lifestyle preferences as it is a set of political beliefs. Biden, for example, won 85% of U.S. counties with at least one Whole Foods in 2020, but only 32% of those with a Cracker Barrel. Political scientist Lee Drutman argues that a radical election rethink is needed to cool the heated polarization that is currently breaking our democracy. He's in favor of scrapping single-member House districts and replacing them with larger multi-member districts with seats parceled out according to the percentage of the vote that each party receives. That system, known as proportional representation, would increase the number of competitive seats, force candidates to reach beyond their party's base. Such reforms are a long shot, Drutman admits, but the U.S. is in uncharted territory, he notes. It's time to take alternatives seriously while we still have time to consider them. Time for a few of the best columns of the week. We'll take all three from the U.S. this week. Starting with Reason for Hope on the Climate. As one of the authors of a new national climate assessment, said scientist Kate Marvel, I felt a strange new emotion in writing the latest report. Optimism. To be clear, there are plenty of new reasons for despair, with strong evidence linking climate change to specific extreme weather disasters, which are growing in frequency. But in recent years, there has been genuine progress, especially in the transition to green energy. Over the past decade, the cost of wind energy has declined by 70%, and solar has declined 90%. Renewables now make up 80% of new electricity generation capacity. As a result, U.S. greenhouse gas emissions are falling, even as our GDP and population grow. Scientists have warned of what would happen if global temperatures rose 2 degrees Celsius. More heat waves, more uncomfortably hot nights, more downpours, more droughts. But thanks to previous warnings and the work of thousands of scientists, engineers, and policymakers, it's possible that emissions will fall dramatically in the near future. Preventing the worst-case scenarios will still require large-scale changes in how we generate energy. But that transition is underway, and climate science's new message is, we can do this. Fears about urban misery are legitimate. Conservative politicians and Fox News are heavily focusing on the crime, homelessness, open-air drug use, and squalor in cities like Seattle and San Francisco, said Paul Schofield. By glibly dismissing these concerns as hysteria, progressives are making a big mistake and will help elect their ideological opponents. As a progressive political philosopher who studies homelessness, I have found that conditions in urban America truly are worsening. And it's not just right-wingers who think so. Just ask the immigrants, people of color, and dyed-in-the-wool leftists who live in neighborhoods where encampments of tents block sidewalks, syringes litter the streets, kids are harassed by homeless drug users, and doorsteps are defecated on. City dwellers have compassion for the homeless, but people have their limits. Parks and other public spaces are ruined when they're strewn with garbage and waste, and those struggling with mental health are left to harass others unimpeded. Letting suffering people live and sleep outdoors helps no one, including the homeless themselves. When the liberal response is to lecture people about their anxieties or pontificate vaguely about root causes, then voters are going to look elsewhere to be heard. UFOs that can't be explained. Despite decades of investigation, the government cannot explain away the most perplexing UFO sightings, said Garrett M. Graff. That's the conclusion I drew from a 2-year deep dive into declassified documents, government reports, and interviews about thousands of mysterious sightings going back to the 1940s. The majority of those sightings have been found to be secret spy craft, drones and balloons of both U.S. and foreign origin, and other man-made phenomena. But up to 20% of sightings have no explanation, and the government has engaged in a cover-up of that mystery. It's not that the government knows these UFOs are alien spacecraft. What officials find embarrassing to admit is that they're clueless about many startling documented sightings and can't rule out that they are of alien origin. Former CIA Director John Brennan has said that he'd concluded that some UFOs might be proof of a different form of life that we don't yet understand. A recent Pentagon investigation that claimed to have solved most recent UFO sightings conceded that 171 of 366 remain unexplained. The reality is that there is something, or more likely, many things out there, and none of us yet know what. Our in-depth article, The Last Word. Scary title this week. A flesh-eating scourge creeps north. The deadly fungus that causes valley fever is spreading beyond the American Southwest, said Joshua Partlow in the Washington Post. Scientists suspect climate change is to blame. Bakersfield, California. At some point, Eric McIntyre inhaled the fungal spores. He couldn't see them or feel them, and it was weeks before he began to lose energy, to drop weight, to cough up blood at a karaoke bar in Arizona. Now that he's paralyzed from valley fever in a nursing home at age 53, the former U.S. Navy electrician's day begins at 5 a.m., with a rectal tube procedure to release gas trapped in his stomach. The antifungal injections that left him retching and shaking are less frequent now, and the lesions where the fungus grew on his face and arms have faded to scars. But he knows he will never be cured, or probably walk again. I try not to dwell on what could have been, he said. McIntyre can imagine the moment he encountered those microscopic spores. He remembers driving across dusty Phoenix suburbs with his windows down, but he can't be sure. These days, the fungus could be anywhere. Valley fever has long haunted the American Southwest. Soldiers on dusty military bases, prisoners in windswept jails, construction workers pushing new suburbs farther into the deserts have all encountered coccidioides. Let me spell that. C-O-C-C-I-D-I-O-I-D-E-S. Coccidioides. The flesh-eating fungus that causes valley fever. But the threat is growing. Cases have roughly quadrupled over the past two decades, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. A key reason for valley fever's spread, researchers say, may be human-driven climate change. And they warn that a much larger area of the United States will become vulnerable to the disease in the decades to come. The fungus thrives in dry soils, rides on plumes of dust, and booms after periods of extreme drought, the exact cycles that scientists say have grown more intense and widespread across the American West due to the warming climate. While science is not yet able to show a definitive link between the rising case counts and higher temperatures, the connection seems clear to many of the frontline health workers grappling with the disease. I cannot think of any other infection that is so closely entwined with climate change, said Rasha Karan, an infectious disease specialist at the University of California, Los Angeles, who is one of McIntyre's doctors. Today, valley fever affects tens of thousands, probably hundreds of thousands, federal officials say, of people each year. And in rare cases, such as McIntyre's, it can be extremely debilitating, even fatal. Cocci, as researchers call the fungus, is primarily found in the Southwest, but also in parts of Central and South America. In the United States, it kills a few hundred people each year, according to the federal officials, about as many as West Nile virus, the leading cause of mosquito-borne disease in the continental United States. But public health officials warn that the illness could become more prevalent as drought pushes more agricultural fields into fallow ground, subdivisions sprout in the desert, and the West dries out. Cases in California appear to be marching north from their traditional home in the San Joaquin Valley, where the illness got its name. Researchers are bracing for an explosion of cases as the ground dries, said Jennifer Head, a University of Michigan epidemiologist who studies the fungus. This fall, she predicted, is when we'll start to see a huge spike in valley fever. In a barren expanse of Southern California scrubland, Head crouched down and fed a long-handled spoon into a rat hole. Wearing an N95 mask and blue plastic gloves, She filled several test tubes with dry, crumbling soil from the Carrizo Plain National Monument. Then she turned to her colleague and asked for a bit more protection. "I feel like I could use an ethanol spritz," Head said, holding out her hands. Head and her colleagues were scouring the sun-blasted patch of the southern San Joaquin Valley in September in an effort to pinpoint where cacti lives and unravel how it might be spreading. Out here among the salt brush and vinegar weed is an endless web of rodent burrows, home to squirrels, mice, and the giant kangaroo rat, an endangered species the size of a baked potato. When University of California, Berkeley scientists began coming here to study those rodents in 2007, it didn't take long before they started getting sick. A really serious fatigue and lack of appetite. "For a month," said Tim Bean, then a UC Berkeley ecologist who came down with valley fever a couple of years into his research in the Carrizo Plain. "It sucked. But it turned out to be a perfect place to hunt for fungus. There has been a known link between rodents and cacti since the early 1940s. More recently, UC Berkeley mycologist John Taylor and his colleagues discovered that cacti had lost genes and other fungi used to eat plants and gain those for devouring meat. These fungi evolved to eat animals," he said, "and a favorite meal? Dead rats." Taylor believes cacti lives not so much in the soil as in the rodents. And when Head and others began scraping out rodent burrows with spoons in the Carrizo Plain, they found that about 30% of them had cocci, while random tests of the neighboring soil could find the fungus only about 4% of the time. "The fungus is elusive because of the microscopic filaments in the soil are invisible to the naked eye. When the ground gets disturbed, those filaments can break off, sending tiny spores long distances." A 1977 California Central Valley dust storm, known as the Tempest from Tehachapi, sickened people hundreds of miles north in Sacramento. James Markwise, a microbiologist with the Environmental Protection Agency in Oregon, suspects that the growing wildfire footprint in the West might also be spreading spores. He knows smoke transports bacteria and fungi, and research in California found that hospital visits for valley fever rose 20% following the wildfires. Within California, the number of reported valley fever cases rose 800% from 2000 to 2022, according to the state's Department of Public Health. Cases have been increasing fastest in the northern part of the San Joaquin Valley, as well as along the state's southern coast. The biggest spikes happen after droughts end. "The hardy spores can survive during extreme stretches," Head said, "then flourish into a kind of fungal superbloom during wet winters. When the ground eventually dries, spores start flying around and cases take off. The past winter in California was one of the wettest on record. The state has been reporting about 7,000 to 9,000 cases of valley fever over each of the past few drought-stricken years." Head predicted a spike once the rains ended California's drought. "I would expect we would see over 10,000 cases in California this year." Before the onslaught of snow and rain this winter, California and the West had endured one of the driest two-decade periods in more than 1,000 years. Wells in the Central Valley ran dry by the hundreds. The price of water for irrigation skyrocketed. And Jace White, 33, could no longer afford to grow blueberries on a 55-acre parcel outside Fresno. White was preparing to fallow that ground by hauling away an old storage container. The work kicked up dust from a patch of earth long undisturbed. For some reason, he lingered on the site. "The dirt caught my eye," he recalled. 3 weeks later, in early April, he woke up in the middle of the night struggling to breathe with a sharp pain in his left side. White's battle with valley fever was the most severe illness of his life. At night, he sweated torrents into his bedsheets. During the day, he lacked the strength to swipe his cell phone. Doctors punctured his back and drained nearly a gallon of fluid from his lungs. His lips cracked and his hair fell out from the antifungal treatments. He lost at least 30 pounds. "I wouldn't wish it on anyone," White said. More than half of people who get valley fever feel no symptoms. Those who do are often misdiagnosed because symptoms, cough, fatigue, fever, night sweats, mirror other common illnesses such as pneumonia or flu. CDC officials estimate that about 500,000 people might get valley fever annually, even though reported cases hover around 20,000. Within about 2 months, White had recovered enough to return to work. After a year, he was told he could stop taking medication. In this, he was fortunate. For 2 to 4% of patients, the fungus spreads out from the lungs, disseminating into the brain, spinal column, or elsewhere, transforming valley fever into a lifelong chronic illness that cannot be cured, only managed. When McIntyre got sick in early 2018, he tried to tough it out, treating his worsening symptoms with turmeric home remedies and over-the-counter cold medicines. It wasn't until lesions suddenly appeared that he went to an emergency room in Phoenix. "One morning, I am looking at my arm, and I've got these bumps all over," he said. "And I look in the mirror, and they're, like, all on my face." By that time, the fungus had expanded beyond his lungs, spreading into his bones and throughout his central nervous system. In Arizona, he had worked from home, tracking doctor visits for a healthcare company. But his physical deterioration forced him to move in with his sister, then to an apartment for military veterans. It was hard for those around him to know what was wrong. He grew confused, and he staggered when he walked. Doctors at one hospital assumed he was drunk and sent him to a homeless shelter in Bakersfield. "Imagine, this man wasn't even drinking, and he gets labeled as an alcoholic," said Karan, who oversaw his emergency treatments at Kern Medical in Bakersfield. By the time she saw him in May 2019, McIntyre could hardly speak and felt numb from the chest down. Karan administered regular injections of aflatoxin B, a powerful antifungal drug, into a plastic pouch inserted under his scalp. Despite the treatment, the inflammation around his spinal cord caused enough damage to leave him paralyzed from the waist down. "It's like having a fire and you're trying to put it out," said Karan, who is also associate medical director at the hospital's Valley Fever Institute. "There was nothing we could do. We gave him the maximal treatments, but the process had already started." Over months of treatment, McIntyre regained his cognition, but it became clear he would never walk again. The paralysis had led to other complications, including urinary tract infections and kidney stones. In the nursing home, he posts videos to TikTok from his bed, talks to relatives, and attends physical therapy sessions. He knows he deserves to be angry or miserable, but he tries to keep a sense of humor. "I'm a fun guy," he said. "I'm filled with it." He tries not to get too discouraged about his health. He sees the fungus as part of God's plan for him. "That's kind of why I think it may have happened to me. I could take it. God knew that," he said. "It was one last test." But it was one he never saw coming. Even though he'd spent most of his life in California and Arizona, valley fever was not something he spent time worrying about. "I'd never heard of it," he said. A version of this story was originally appeared in the Washington Post. We're reading an obituary today. the first lady who championed mental health care, Rosalynn Carter, 1927 to 2023. Rosalynn Carter was a key policy advisor to her husband, President Jimmy Carter, and a full partner in his work, not only in the White House, but also for decades after, as the couple dedicated themselves to humanitarian causes. He called her an extension of myself. Instrumental on the campaign trail, she was assertive in the role of presidential spouse, establishing the first office of the First Lady in the East Wing. Often described as the most politically active First Lady since Eleanor Roosevelt, Carter attended cabinet meetings, testified before Congress, and led a 13-day diplomatic trip to seven countries across Latin America. Some people criticized her level of involvement, particularly during the 1979 Iran hostage crisis, when she didn't consult the president before asking his brother, Billy Carter, to use his Libya connections to try to win release for the American diplomats held in Tehran. When asked whether she had too much influence on policy for an unelected spouse, she said she had always worked alongside her husband and would not stop. "I can't stay at home and do cokes and teas," she said in 1978. "I really believe that I can help." Eleanor Rosalynn Carter was delivered by Jimmy Carter's mother, who was a nurse, in the 600-person farming town of Plains, Georgia. Her future husband caught his first glimpse of her when he was just three, and he peeked into her bassinet. Her father, an auto mechanic, died when she was 13, leaving her mother, a dressmaker, struggling to survive on an insurance policy that paid $18.75 a month. Rosalynn took care of her three younger siblings. Despite these hardship and obligations, she was valedictorian of her high school class, said the New York Times, and she went on to Georgia Southwestern, a junior college. While she was best friends with Jimmy's younger sister, Ruth, she didn't have much interaction with him until she was 18, and they went on their first date. They married less than a year later, in 1946, after a whirlwind courtship, said the Washington Post. Jimmy, then 21, had just graduated from the Naval Academy, and Rosalynn thought she was destined to travel as the wife of a dashing naval officer. But his father's death in 1953 forced Jimmy to abandon his military career for the family peanut farm. "At the prospect of returning to their tiny hometown, I argued, I cried," Rosalynn wrote in her memoir. "I thought the best part of my life had ended." But then the couple had three sons. Their daughter Amy was born in 1967. When her husband went into politics and won a Georgia State Senate seat, her innate political shrewdness became undeniable, said NBCNews.com. A savvy campaigner, she could get people to talk to her about what really mattered to them, and she became a tireless administrator when the couple reached the governor's mansion in 1970. By the time they got to the White House, the press had dubbed her Steel Magnolia for her combination of toughness and Southern charm. Unlike her husband, she enjoyed politics, and she was deeply bitter about losing the presidency to Ronald Reagan. It was after the White House, though, that she found her true calling, said NPR.org. Rosalynn had begun pushing to modernize mental health services as First Lady of Georgia, framing mental health care as a basic human right, and she continued that work through the Carter Center, which the couple ran together. The Carters drew on their shared Christian faith to fuel a life dedicated to charitable work, promoting peace, health projects, and election integrity around the globe. In 1999, they jointly received the Presidential Medal of Freedom for that work. Rosalynn developed dementia toward the end of her life, but never failed to recognize her husband of 77 years as they spent their final days together in the same one-story Plains ranch house they'd had since 1961. "Life with Jimmy Carter," she said in 2021, "has been an adventure." And we'll flip over to the talking points page to finish out start with the article, Haley, A Narrow Path to the Nomination. Could Nikki Haley really beat Donald Trump? Asked Ross Douthat in the New York Times. Buoyed by a series of strong debate showings, the feisty former South Carolina governor is rising in the polls and drawing praise as an appealing and charismatic leader who is showing that you can thrive as a Republican without surrendering to Trumpism. Polls show support for Haley has jumped 10 points in crucial Iowa, whose caucuses start the GOP nomination contest. She's now running even there with Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, whose Trump-like campaign is floundering. And in New Hampshire, another early primary state, Haley is polling at 20% to DeSantis' 9%. Big money donors are increasingly lining up behind Haley as the GOP's best bet to beat Trump, said Frederica Shelton in CNN.com. Everything I hear is folks moving to Haley, said GOP fundraiser Eric Levine. Haley has a narrow path to the nomination, said David Friedlander in New York Magazine. A strong finish in Iowa would propel her into New Hampshire, where she could galvanize independents, then her home state of South Carolina, where she has strong support and existing campaign infrastructure. If Trump, whose image is built on being a winner above all else, loses in one or two states and starts looking vulnerable, it would scramble the remaining map and polling. Trump's poll lead is large, but it's soft. 41% of his backers say they're open to a more electable alternative. Swing state polls show Haley is a pragmatic, Reagan-style conservative, is far more electable in the general than the increasingly deranged Trump, said Christian Schneider in National Review. As other candidates drop out, she can start looking like a winner, a narrative that takes on a life of its own. Haley may be surging, said Ben Mathis Lilly in Slate, but she's still completely irrelevant. As she vies to finish a strong second in early primaries, Trump remains in first place, 40 or more points ahead. A conviction in one of his four criminal trials could hurt him, but his first trial on federal charges that he corruptly tried to overturn the 2020 election won't start in D.C. until March, after the Iowa and New Hampshire votes. So Haley, with her buzzy big money campaign, have no choice but to focus on ousting DeSantis and the second-tier candidates, and hope she gets a head-to-head battle with Trump before he wraps up the nomination. And we'll read some of the shorter notes. The number of students skipping school has soared since the pandemic. About 66% of students attended schools with high or extreme levels of chronic absenteeism in the 2021-22 school year, compared with 26% in 2017-18. Nearly 30% of students, some 15 million children, were categorized last year as chronically absent, defined as missing at least 10% of school days. More than 100 United Nations aid workers have been killed in Gaza since Israel's war with Hamas began, and dozens more have been wounded. That's the largest single conflict toll on humanitarian workers in the UN's 78-year history. By the end of next year, the U.S. will have lost a third of the 8,891 newspapers it had in 2005, according to a study from Northwestern University. Nearly 5,000 of the roughly 6,000 papers left in the U.S. publish weekly, not daily. About 6% of U.S. counties now have no local news outlet. Degenerative brain damage may be far more widespread in youth football players than originally thought. Boston University researchers examined the brains of 152 contact sport athletes who died before age 30 and found that more than 40% had chronic traumatic encephalopathy. More than three quarters of those belonged to high schools and college football players. On the poll watch, 38% of Americans say Israel's military response to Hamas attack has gone too far, a 12% increase from last month, including 56% of Democrats, 42% of independents, and 14% of Republicans. 38% say the response has been about right. And we will finish today's show with a quote from Warren Buffett, quoted in CNBC.com, who says, "Read 500 pages every day. That's how knowledge works. It builds up like compound interest." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you have enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.